be a band of uranium dust between those two towns. He explained to them about cyclo-breathe gas.
Aye, it fits, said Robert the Fox.
The historian looked enlightened and drew his shabby old cloak around his shrunken shoulders.
It sounds like the magic ring of fire, or the geometric signs the creatures of the netherworld dare not cross.
Johnny looked at the eroded remains of the weapon in his hands, and then along the trench. These poor men didn't have any uranium, didn't even really know about cyclos. They had only these.
They died like brave men, said the parson, removing his cap.
The others also removed theirs. We just have to be sure, said Johnny. We don't wind up like them.
Aye, said Robert the Fox.
Johnny laid the remains of the gun down, and they walked back thoughtfully toward the cooking fires. The wail of a piper was soft in the night wind. 3. Turl was working with maps of the mountains. He had the latest recon drone pictures of the lode, and he was trying to find any trails or roads that came near this deep gash. It was one awfully difficult operation, and when he thought about the animals undertaking something that would make an experienced cyclo miner cough, it put spots in front of his eyes. The site was simply not accessible by ground travel. His newly acquired secretary, Chirk, came in. She was stupid enough not to be any menace and good-looking enough to be decorative. She got drunk with economical speed and had other advantages. Her utility was in blocking off callers and shuffling administration papers back for somebody else to handle. Since he was now in reality the top cyclo on the planet, he shouldn't be bothered with trivial details. Overload the already crushed numph was his motto.
The animal is here to see you, she trilled.
Turl had hastily covered up the maps when her paws touched the door. He scraped them into a top drawer and out of sight.
Send it in.
Wearing his air mask and clothing of chinko cloth, Johnny came in. He had a long list in his hand. Turl looked at him. Things were working out pretty well. The animal was on his good behavior, despite having no button camera surveillance now. They had an arrangement whereby Johnny could come over every few days and take care of food for the girls and confer. Johnny had suggested a radio link, but Turl had become very cross and adamant. No radio. That was final. The animal could walk his feet off if he wanted to say something to Turl. Turl knew there were plenty of receivers in the mine site, and radio might tip his paw and blow his security.
I have a list, said Johnny.
I can see that, said Turl.
I want piping and chinko cloth and the tools to cut and sew it together and some pumps and shovels.
Give it to Chirk. Sounds like you're rebuilding the whole defense base. Typical animal. Why don't you get busy with the machine instruction?
I am, said Johnny. And it was very true. He had been spending 10 hours a day with the youths and schoolmaster.
I'll send over care, said Turl.
Johnny shrugged. Then he indicated the list. There's a couple of items here that should be cleared with you. The first is the Chinko instruction machines. There are about 6 of them in the old Chinko quarters. The equipment controls are all in cyclo, and so are the manuals. I want to take those and all their discs and books.
So, said Turl.
Johnny nodded.
The other item is flying trucks.
You've got flying platforms.
I think we should have some flying personnel carriers and flying trucks. I've been to see Zut, and he has a whole garage floor full of them.
To Turl's suspicious mind came the sudden feeling that the animal was looking through the desktop at the maps in the drawer. It was very true that there were no roads to that place. All carrying, he realized, would have to be by air, and it would be difficult flying at that. But a flying truck or a personnel carrier had the same controls as a battle plane and fewer guns. There was a hard rule that no alien race could be trained in battle. Then Turl thought of the inaccessible load.
Well, a mining truck was not a battle plane, that was for sure. Besides, he controlled the planet, and he made the rules.
How many you want? Said Turl, reaching for the list. Hey, you've written 20, and tri-wheel ground cars, 3 ground cars.
The order was to train them on equipment, and if I haven't got the equipment...
But 20?
Johnny shrugged. Maybe they're hard on equipment. Turl barked a sudden laugh as he remembered the animal nearly going over the cliff in the burning blade scraper. It tickled him. He drew out one of the blanks Numph had signed and punched the animal's list in above the signature. How much time have I got? Asked Johnny. Turl was too secretive to come flat out with times. The times actually coincided with the semi-annual firing of personnel and dead cyclos. He calculated rapidly. 9 months total. Maybe 3 months for training to the next transshipment, and 6 months for mining to the second in the early spring of next year. Better give it an edge.
2 months to get them all trained, said Turl.
That's awfully fast. Turl took the remote control box out of his pocket and tapped it and put it back. He laughed. Johnny frowned, his face mask obscuring the dangerous light that had leaped into his eyes. He took a tight hold of his temper and voice. I could use care to help ferry this stuff.
Tell Chirk.
Also, said Johnny, I need some experience operating over those mountains. The updrafts and downdrafts are very strong, and in winter they'll be worse. I don't want you getting ideas if I fly around up there. Turl put his paws protectively on the desktop as though to block a view into the drawer. Then he realized he was getting jumpy. Still, the longer he kept things in the dark, the less chance there was of the animals talking to other personnel. He began to weave an elaborate fantasy to explain to others why animals were flying in the mountains.
You seem to know an awful lot, he said suddenly.
Only what you've told me, said Johnny.
When?
Different times. Over in Scotland. Turl stiffened. True, he had been unguarded. Very unguarded if this stupid rat brain had picked it up.
If I hear just one leak of this real project, through care or anybody else,
he tapped the control box in his pocket.
The smaller female is going to have a collar explosion.
I know that, said Johnny.
So get out, said Turl. I'm far too busy for all this chatter.
Johnny had Chirk copy the requisition on a duplicator and asked her to call Care to help ferry the equipment.
Here you are, animal,
she said, when she was through and handed him the copies. My name is Johnny.
Mine is Chirk.
She batted her painted eye bones.
You animals are kind of funny and cute. How can you be so much fun to hunt, like some of the employees say? You certainly don't look dangerous. And I don't think you are even edible. Crazy planet. No wonder poor Turl hates it so. We're going to have a huge house when we go home next year.
A huge house? Said Johnny, looking up at this rattlebrain in wonder.
Oh, yes, we'll be rich. Turl says so. Ta-ta, Johnny. Bring me a sack of goodies when you want a favor next time.
Thank you, I will, said Johnny. He went out with his warehouse-sized list to get busy. He knew he had a new piece of the puzzle. Turl would not be here more than a year. Turl was going home, and going home rich. 4. I am sorry, gentlemen, said Johnny to his counsel. They were seated on some bashed-up chairs in what had become Johnny's combined quarters and office, a spacious room that overlooked most of the area, chosen because it had whole windows. Johnny pointed to the stacks of books. I have searched through everything I can find and am unable to locate it. Robert the Fox, Dr. McDermott, the parson, and the schoolmaster sat glumly looking at him. He never tried to fool them about anything. One thing about McTyler,
He was honest with them. Things had been going well, too. Almost too well. The young men were progressing marvelously in their ability to handle equipment. There had been only one casualty with the flying trucks. Two trainees had been attacking each other's trucks in the air, in simulated combat, and one of the young lads had punched a wrong button at the wrong time and hit the ground. He was lying in the infirmary now, leg properly set by the parson, and attended by the clucking old widows. The flying truck, according to Kerr, who came over to fix it, was fit only to be cannibalized. The three young men who looked like Johnny had bruised hands from the schoolmaster's ruler. The schoolmaster kept them at the instruction machines from dawn to noon when they went off to study vehicles. They were learning cyclo under heavy pressure and doing it very well. Several young men had caught wild horses and broken them to ride, and they rounded up wild cattle and shot deer so there was no lack of food. Radishes and lettuce brightened their fare, proud trophies of the old women's garden. In fact, everyone was working like fury, and the place looked like an anthill all day.
"Perhaps," said Dr. McDermott, "we could help you, Luke."
He gestured at the books.
"If you tell us exactly what it is we're to be locating."
"It's uranium," said Johnny. "The key to this battle is uranium."
"Ah, yes," said Dr. McDermott. "It isn't harmful to humans, but is deadly to cyclos."
"It is harmful to humans," said Johnny, pointing to a toxicology text. "Given too much exposure to it, some humans die rather frightfully. But it apparently ignites the breathe gas of cyclos and makes it explode. It is uniformly fatal to them." "These mountains," he continued, sweeping his hand toward the mountains outlined by the sunset behind them, "are supposed to have been full of uranium. I know definitely the cyclos believe they are. You can't force a cyclo up into them. The demon Turl is going to send us into those mountains to find, probably, gold. He has undoubtedly spotted some. We may or may not mine the gold. Probably we would have to keep going. But we could also mine uranium."
"And you can't locate any," said Dr. McDermott.
Johnny shook his head. "There's even lists of uranium mines, but they're all marked mined out, mine closed, that sort of thing."
"Must have been very valuable," said Robert the Fox.
"They list a lot of uses for it," said Johnny, "mainly military." The parson rubbed his nose thoughtfully.
"Would your own village people know anything?"
"No," said Johnny. "They're one of the proofs that there is uranium up there. That's why I have not taken you gentlemen there, much as I would like to. I'm certain their illnesses and inability to reproduce have a lot to do with uranium."
"It doesn't seem to have affected you, MacTyler,"
smiled the parson. "I wandered a lot and was not home much of the time, and some are affected more than others, perhaps."
"Heredity," said Dr. McDermott. "Over the centuries, some of you may have developed a resistance or an immunity. They would not know."
Johnny shook his head. "I haven't gone up there because I don't want to stir them up. The recon drone flies daily. But one day soon, I must find a way to move them, and a place to move them, too. No, they would know nothing about uranium, or they would have long since quit that valley. We do have to solve this problem," he continued. "It is the center of every plan." Dr. McDermott held out his hand.
"Deal those books around, and we will put aside some of our sleep and help you look."
Johnny started handing them books in rotation.
"I think," said Robert the Fox, "we should send out some scouts. It is basic in the planning of any successful raid that one sends out some scouts first. How do you recognize this uranium?"
"Indicators are there in the mine books," said Johnny. "But the main tool we do not have. It's called a Geiger counter, and though I've looked it up and have a vague idea of how one is made, the point is we don't have one."
"Perhaps," said the schoolmaster, "there may be one in some of these old villages. Do they have directories for factories?"
"I doubt such an instrument would be worth much after 1,000 years, said Dr. McDermott. "But I do see there, goodness, but this has almost gone to pieces. A telephone? Book? To Dev... Denv... Telephones, he added for the others, used to exist in cities. Here. Instruments. International Business Machines Research. Oh, drat. The address can't be made out.
The writing exists on many buildings there, said Johnny. Robert the Fox leaned forward.
As I see, it takes a scout. Scout before raid is the watchword. We must be very careful that the demons do not suspect us of snooping about.
They have body heat detectors, said Johnny. That's how you escaped them, clinging under a horse. They knew horses were running away. But the recon drone takes only pictures, and one should get under cover when he hears the rumble far off. The sound of a ground car, however, means real danger, for they have spinners that fly up in the air and look for heat. I have some covers that we can throw over ourselves to block heat, but we have to be very, very careful. I think it's best that I go.
Nay, nay, said Robert the Fox, his accent thickening into dialect from sudden alarm. We canna hae ye do that, laddie.
The rest of the council also shook their heads. The parson said,
You keep yourself safe, McTyler. That's why we're here, to help you.
The small demon, said Johnny. The one that came to fix the flying machine.
The same, said Johnny. His name's Care. He told me an order had been issued, he said by the planet head, to forbid all hunting parties in this whole area and to restrict them all to the mining areas and compound. There was some talk, Care said, of coming over here for some sport. So there aren't any demons wandering around, and it's perfectly safe to go up to the great village on a scout, so long as we don't stay inside of the recon drone.
Scouts, said Robert the Fox firmly, are not done by chiefs. Raids, perhaps. Scouts, no. We will send young Angus McTavish. All those in favor?
And Johnny was firmly voted down. Thus it was that young Angus McTavish went scouting to Denver in a small ground car in the dark that night. He was peculiarly adept at operating machinery. He had taken piping and brought the water closer, and he had worked out how the water mains and sewers worked, and he had even gotten a couple of inside toilets working, to the amazement of his friends. He was gone 48 hours and came back with a lot of wonders to report. But the International Business Machines Research Laboratories were in ruins that bore no fruit. There was nothing there even vaguely resembling the Geiger counter that had been described to him. He had also located a Bureau of Mines, but it had only decayed records. He discovered a prospector's outfitter, and though he had found some stainless steel sample picks that he brought back, and an assortment of stainless steel knives that delighted the old women in their work, there had been no Geiger counter there either. The council met again and grimly decided to carry on and get ready anyway, and the parson said a prayer that pleaded with the good Lord to have pity on them and lead them somewhere, somehow, to a Geiger counter and uranium. They also decided to send out more scouts, but without too much hope. 5. Johnny awoke in the middle of the night to the abrupt realization that he knew where a uranium detector existed. The ore duster at the transshipment area. He had even spent apprentice time on it. So, despite Robert the Fox's prohibition against his scouting, Johnny was on a scout, dangerous or not. Every few days he saw Chrissy. Each time he did, he made it a habit to ride around the mine site idly just to accustom the cyclos to his being there. He would sit windsplitter and wander around. Today, Chrissy and Patty looked very forlorn. Johnny had brought fresh meat and more deerskin for them to tan and sew. He had cut plenty of firewood. One of the Scots had unearthed a stainless steel axe from a village ruin, and it made such work remarkably fast. He placed all this outside the wooden barrier to be taken in when Turl was not busy and could come out. It was frustrating to talk through the wooden barrier and the cage bars. Chrissy and Patty held up some buckskin shirts and breeches for him to admire, and then repackaged them for him to take. He called to them that they looked fine. Patty exhibited a new arrangement for their pitiful shelter. They could fasten nothing to the bars, and he said it looked much better. What was he doing? They wanted to know. He said he was working. And was he all right? Yes, he was fine. And were things going well? Just fine. Difficult to carry on a conversation across a space of 40 feet, through two screening barricades and under the surveillance of at least 2 button cameras. Difficult to be calm and reassuring when what he really wanted to do was blow the place up and get them out of there. He had a picto recorder on a strap around his neck. With a couple of buckskin thongs, he had steadied it to his chest so that with a slight motion of his hand, he could start and stop it without raising it to his eye. He had practiced doing that and had gotten pretty accurate at pointing it without looking through the finder. He requisitioned 12 of the things and plenty of miniature discs. As he talked, he took pictures of the girls and the cage from several angles. Pictures of the switchbox and wires. It was a risk, he knew. He told Chrissy and Patty he would be back and rode casually to a high point above the Chinko quarters. Seemingly idle, he took broad panoramas, both wide-angle and telephoto, of the mine site. He took pictures of the 20 battle planes lined up in the field, the distant cartridge fuel dump, and, beyond that, the breathe gas storage dump. He took pictures of the morgue 100 yards beyond the transshipment area. And he covered the freighter landing area and ramps and conveyor belt and control tower. Then, luck. He saw a freighter on its way in with a load of ore. He idled down off the knoll. As he passed the cage, he felt a sudden need for cautiousness. He dismounted and slipped the discs he had already taken into the waiting pack, making it appear that he was just putting in some flowers. Remounted, he wandered on down to the ore dusting area. He let Windsplitter pause near tasty clumps of grass and at last came to the dust-coated area of transshipment. The freighter had not unloaded yet. Employees were coming out and getting onto their machines. He rode up to the ore-dusting machine. The operator was not there. A hook was swinging from a crane, and he pretended to duck it. But in actual fact, he leaned over and pulled out a wire from the back of the machine's controls. He did not know its circuit, but with luck he would very soon. The operator knew him slightly from his apprentice days, but glanced at him with normal cyclo-disdain.
You better get that horse out of here, or coming in.
Johnny backed Windsplitter off. The freighter discharged with a dusty roar. The blade machines raced about, neatening up the pile. The first load was ready for the buckets on the conveyor belt. A red light flared. A horn went off. The ore duster operator cursed and banged at his controls. All activity stopped. The air around the operator's dome and mask might well have turned blue from his cursing. Char came rumbling like a tank out of the dome of the transshipment control office, shouting as he came. Far off was the faint moan of another freighter coming in from an overseas mine site. It was not a transshipment firing day, but schedules were about to ball up on freighter discharge. Char was shouting for electronics repair, and somebody in the dome on the loudspeaker system was demanding to know where the duty electronics was. Johnny could have told them where duty electronics was. He'd seen the employee walking toward the compound 15 minutes ago. Char was raving at the operator on the ore duster. The operator was hammering paws on the control panel. Johnny slid off his horse and went to them. I can fix it. With a roar that had concussion in it, Char told him to get the blank out of there. No, I can fix it, said Johnny. A voice coming closer said, Let him fix it. I trained him. It was Care. Char was distracted by the new interruption. He whirled to storm abuse at the midget cyclo. Picto recorder running, Johnny slid up to the front of the ore duster control panel. He snapped it open. He stood at right angles to the layout of components and pretended to study it. Then he reached in and touched a couple of points, doing nothing to them. Given pictures of this, he could build it. He closed the box. He rapidly connected the wire he had earlier loosened. Char turned back to him after chomping on care. "It's fixed," said Johnny. "It was just a loose wire." Care yelled to the operator, "Try it now." The operator did, and the ore duster purred. "See," said Care, "I trained him myself." Johnny got back on Windsplitter, using the motion to turn off his picto recorder.
"It's working now," said the operator.
Char looked venom at Johnny.
"You keep that horse out of this area. If this was a firing time, he'd land in Cyclo."
He went off muttering something about damned animals. The conveyor belt and buckets and machines were roaring away again, making haste to clear the load before the new freighter came in. The old one took off. Windsplitter wandered down toward the morgue. This building, remarkable for its refrigerator coils, stood well back. Johnny turned and looked from it back at the compound. It was a straight course from here across the transshipment platform and up the hill to the cage.
"And what," said a voice, "are you doing down here with a picto recorder?"
It was Turl. He had stepped out of the morgue and had a list in his hand. In the dark reaches of the building, coffins were stacked. Turl had been checking Cyclo corpses scheduled for return home at the semi-annual firing. "Practicing," answered Johnny.
"Or what?" growled Turl.
"Sooner or later, you'll want me to take pictures for you up in the..."
"Don't talk about that around here."
Turl tossed his list back of him toward the morgue and stepped close to Johnny. He yanked the picto recorder off Johnny's chest, snapping the holding straps. The thongs bit into Johnny's back as they resisted just before they gave. Turning the machine over, Turl snapped the disc out of it, threw it in the dust, and stamped on it with his boot heel. He poked sharp talons into Johnny's belt and flipped out four more discs.
"They're just blanks," said Johnny.
Turl threw those into the dust and ground them under a heavy toe. He shoved the picto recorder back at Johnny.
"It's a company rule not to record a transshipment area."
"When you want me to take pictures," said Johnny, "I hope you'll be able to make them out."
"I better be able to," snarled Turl illogically, and stamped back into the morgue.
Later, when Johnny was let in to take Chrissy's supplies, he had no trouble slipping the earlier discs from his incoming pack to Chrissy's outgoing pack. But they weren't the circuit diagrams that would detect uranium. Out of plain revenge, that night he showed his whole crew the earlier pictures he had taken. He showed them all the locations of the whole transshipment area. He would have to do it again later when proper plans were formed. But for now, he wanted to show them pictures of Chrissy and Patty. The shots showed the girls, showed the collars, showed the switch box to the bars. But mainly it showed their faces, the faces of a little girl and a beautiful woman. The Scots watched the pictures, attentive to the geography of the transshipment area, the battle planes, the breathe gas dump, the fuel dump, the morgue, and the platform. But when they saw the pictures of Chrissy and Patty, they began with pity and ended with rage. Robert the Fox had to speak again to prevent them from tearing over right then and ripping the place to pieces. The pipers played a mournful lament. If the Scots had been enthusiastic before, they were deadly determined and angry now. But Johnny lay unable to sleep that night. He had had it right in the camera, the circuit of a uranium detector. He had not memorized it. He had counted upon getting the pictures. He blamed himself for depending on machines. Machines were all right, but they did not replace man. There would come a day of reckoning with Turl. He vowed it bitterly. 6. In the clear, cold noon, they were on their way for a first look at the load. Johnny, Robert the Fox,
the three who looked similar to Johnny, and the two Scott mining shift leaders who had been appointed, sped along in the small personnel carrier high above the grandeur of the Rockies. Turl had come early that morning, threatening and secretive. His ground car had been spotted some time since by a posted sentry, and Johnny had been warned. Wrapped in a puma skin against the dawn chill, Johnny met the ground car as it stopped. Breakfast was just over in the mess hall, and a warning had been sent to stay inside. The grounds were nearly deserted, and there was nothing to distract Turl's attention. He got out, tightening his breathe mask, and stood there tossing the remote control box idly into the air and catching it in his paw.
"Why," said Turl, "are you interested in a uranium detector?"
Johnny frowned and looked mystified, or tried to.
"I heard after you left the other day that you repaired the ore duster. With a picto recorder around your neck? Ha!"
Johnny decided on a sudden verbal attack.
"You expect me to go up into those mountains without knowing what to avoid? You expect me to go tearing around, getting myself wrecked?"
"Wrecked?"
"Physically wrecked, from uranium contamination."
"See here, animal, you can't talk this way to me."
"When you know very well that I could be made sick if I didn't avoid uranium dust. You've told me there's uranium up there, and you expect me..."
"Wait a minute," said Turl. "What are you talking about?"
"Mining toxicology," snapped Johnny.
The kilted sentry who had called him was standing by the mess hall door, looking daggers and dirks at Turl.
"Sentry," shouted Johnny, "grab a book, any book in English, and bring it here, fast."
Johnny turned back to Turl. The running footsteps of the sentry could be heard inside the building. Turl put the control box back in his pocket so his gun paw could be free just in case. The sentry rushed out with an ancient volume labeled The Poems of Robert Burns. He had snatched it from the parson who was reading at breakfast. It would have to do. Johnny snapped it open. He put his finger on a line that said, "We sleek it cowerin timorous beastie." "See there?" he demanded of Turl. "In the presence of uranium, a man's hair falls out, his teeth fall out, his skin develops red blotches, and his bones crumble. And it happens in just a few weeks of exposure."
"You don't explode?"
said Turl. "It doesn't say anything here about explosion, but it says that continuous exposure to uranium dust can be fatal. Read it yourself." Turl looked at a line that said something like, "Oh, what a panic's in thy breastie," and said,
"So it does. I didn't know that."
"You know it now," said Johnny. He closed and thumped the book. "I found this by accident. You didn't tell me. Now, are you going to let me have a detector or aren't you?" Turl looked thoughtful.
"So your bones turn to dust, do they? And it takes a few months?"
"Weeks," said Johnny. Turl began to laugh. His paw dropped from his belt gun, and he swatted himself in the chest, catching his breath.
"Well," he said at length, "I guess you'll just have to take your chances, won't you?"
It hadn't worked, but Turl was totally off the scent now, actually feeling more secure.
"That wasn't what I came over here for anyway," said Turl. "Can we go someplace less public?"
Johnny handed the book back to the sentry with a wink to reassure him. The Scot had enough sense not to grin. But Turl was rummaging around the ground car. He beckoned Johnny to follow and took him back of the chapel where there were no windows. He had a big roll of maps and photos, and he sat down on the ground. He motioned for Johnny to hunker down.
"Your animals are all trained,"
said Turl.
"As well as can be expected."
"Well, notice you've had a couple extra weeks."
"They'll do."
"All right now. We have come to the time to be real miners."
He rolled out the map. It was a patch-up of sectional running shots from a recon drone, and it condensed about 2,000 square miles of the Rocky Mountains from Denver to the west.
"You can read one of these?"
Yes, said Johnny. Turl snapped the head of a canyon with his talon.
It's there.
Johnny could almost feel the surge of greed in Turl. His voice was a conspiratorial mutter.
It's a load of white quartz with streamers of pure gold in it. It's a freak, exposed by a landslide in recent years.
And he took a large photograph out of the pack. There it was, a diagonal slash of white in the red side of a canyon. Turl took a closer shot and showed it. Fingers of pure gold could be seen threading through the quartz. Johnny would have spoken, but Turl held up his paw to stop him.
You fly over and take a close look at it. When you've seen it and gotten it oriented as a mining problem, you come back and see me, and I will clarify any questions as to procedure.
He tapped the location on the larger map.
Memorize that spot.
Johnny noted that the map bore no markings. Clever Turl. No clues if the map went adrift. He sat there and let Johnny study the map. Johnny knew these mountains, but he had never had a detailed picture of them from this angle, above. Turl put all his papers away except the map.
Hold on to that.
He stood up. How long do we have to get it out? Said Johnny.
Day 91 of the coming year. That's 6.5 months away.
That's also winter, said Johnny. Turl shrugged.
It's always winter up there. 10 months of winter and 2 months of fall.
He laughed.
Fly over and look at it, animal. Take a week or two to study it out. And then come over and we'll have a private meeting. And this is confidential, do you hear? Outside of your animals, say nothing.
Turl had gone off playing catch with the control box. His ground car roared away back to the compound. A couple of hours later, Johnny's party was flying high above the Rockies.
That's the first time, said one of the Scots behind Johnny, that I knew Robbie Burns was toxic.
Johnny turned. He thought the sentry must have gotten aboard. You speak Cyclo that well?
Of course,
said the Scot and showed the ruler bruises on the back of his hand. He was one of the lads chosen because of his resemblance to Johnny.
I was putting an ear to a window on the second floor above you. He can't understand English, can he?
One of our very few advantages, said Johnny. I didn't get the uranium detector.
Well, said Robert the Fox, it's a very optimistic man that thinks he can win all the battles. What are all those villages doing there?
It was true. There were old towns here and there throughout this section of the mountains. They're deserted, said Johnny. I've been to some of them. No population but rats. Mining ghost towns.
'Tis a sad thing, said Robert the Fox. All this space and all kinds of food and no people. And over in Scotland, there's little space that will grow anything, and hardly any food at all. It's a dark chapter in history we've been through.
We'll change it,
said a young Scot behind him.
Aye, said Robert the Fox, if we have any luck. All this great broad world full of food and no people. What are the names of those grand peaks down there?
I don't know, said Johnny. If you look on the mine map, you'll see they just give them numbers. I think they had names once, but people forgot. That one over there we just call High Peak.
Hey, said a young Scot, there's sheep down on that mountainside.
He was using a hand telescope. They're called bighorns, said Johnny. It's quite a feat to hunt one down. They can stand on a ledge not bigger than your hand and sail off and land on another one not wider than 2 fingers.
And there's a bear, said the Scot. What a big one.
The bears will go into hibernation soon, said Johnny. I'm surprised one is out at this altitude.
Some wolves are following him, said the Scot.
Laddies, said Robert the Fox, we are hunting bigger game. Keep your eye out for the canyon.
Johnny spotted it shortly before 1 o'clock. 7. It was a startling sight. The grandeur of the scene in this thin, cold air made one feel small. Out of a river, a thin silver thread in the depths far below reared a reddish, massive wall of rock rising sheer and raw. Narrowly across from it was its echoing face. Down through the eons, the river, finding a softer strata between the two faces, had gnawed its turbulent way to make at last this gigantic knife slice in the all but impregnable stone. 1,000 feet deep, 100 yards wide, the enormous wound gaped. All around it rose majestic peaks, hiding it from the world. The sparkling white line of quartz, many feet thick, marked it with a brief diagonal line. And in that quartz, embedded and pure, gold shone and beckoned. It had in its reality a much greater impact than any photograph. It was like a jewel band set upon the wrinkled skin of a hag. One could see far below where a portion of the cliff face had fallen. The fragments lay like crashed pebbles in the depths. The river had eaten too deep under the cliff, and an earthquake had shaken a slice of the face loose. Snow had not yet fallen, for the year was dry, and there was nothing to impede the view. Johnny dropped the plane lower, and then the wind hit them, funneled up the long gorge, compressed and screaming to get free. The turbulent currents tore at the cliff. With fingers racing across the overlarge keys of the console, Johnny fought to keep the light personnel plane in position. It was not a dazzling load at that moment. It was a brutal elemental wall that could crush them if they touched it. Johnny leaped the plane 1,000 feet up, clear of the updrafts, and steadied it. He turned to one of the Scots, the one who looked like him and who had spoken of Burns. His name was Dunaldine McSwanson. "Can you handle this plane?" Dunaldine came forward. Robert the Fox went to a rear seat and strapped himself into the co-pilot seat. In these teleportation drives, there were a number of corrections that had to be constantly watched. Some were built into the computers, some were pre-programmed for any flight. Space itself was absolute and motionless, having no time, energy, or mass of its own. But to stay in one place relative to the mass around one, it was necessary to parallel the track of such mass. The world turned daily, and that was a near 1,000-mile-an-hour correction. The Earth orbited the Sun, and that required second-to-second correction. The solar system was precessing, and even if the correction was minute, it had to be compensated for. The whole solar system was en route to somewhere else at a blinding speed. The universe itself was twisting in relation to other universes. These factors and others made control of the ship a dicey business in normal times. Down there in that canyon, it was a nightmare. The irregular external buffetings of the wind upset the inertia of the motor housing and made instant shifts of coordination continual. Dunaldine had been schooled and trained in all this, but he had seen Johnny's fingers flying over that console and knew it was no routine flight. In the first place, the cyclo keys allowed for wide talons and wider paws, and it required a snapping tension in the wrists to compensate for these spacings with human hands. Dunaldine looked down at the canyon top.
"It is no Rome in the gloamin'," he said, "but I can try."
He started down. Johnny unwrapped his seatbelt and had them pass a small contrivance called a core gun to him. By firing a small rotating borer, the gun would take a 1-inch diameter chunk out of a rock face, the length of the core varying by how long one let the borer stay there before hauling it back on a line. With it, one obtained a cylindrical sample of a vein or rock.
"Start taking pictures," he yelled at the rest of them.
They had 3 picto recorders aboard, an instrument that measured depth below surfaces, and one that measured densities while drawing a pattern. The instruments were light cyclo prospecting tools, but being cyclo, they required a lot of muscle. The Scots took the equipment and began individually operating through the slots in the side of the fuselage. Johnny lowered his own port and readied the core gun.
Take us in as close to the vein as you can get without risking us.
Aye, said Dunnell Dean. There's the rub.
Ready?
Down we go.
They shot back into the chasm. Johnny could hear Dunnell Dean's fingers on the console keys. They sounded like a miniature of that Thompson. Then the sound was blotted out by the shrieking howl of the canyon wind. They swerved. The wall came within inches and swept back to yards. It danced up and down. The scream of the motors began to match the wind as they raced to correct positions. Johnny forced himself to concentrate. He wanted a core on the first shot, for it took time to rewind. The sparkling load danced and leaped in his sights. He pressed the trigger. With a bark and sizzle of paying out line, the corer hit the load. Dead on. He triggered the rotator. The line whipped up and down in the wind. The plane suddenly slid sideways in a sickening swoop and almost hit the opposite wall. The core came out and dangled below the ship. Johnny reeled the looping, twisting line in.
Take her up, he shouted.
Dunnell Dean vaulted the ship up 2,000 feet to quieter air. He sat there, limp, his arms and wrists aching, sweat heavy on his forehead.
Whew, mon! 'Tis like dancing with a devil's wife,
he panted, relapsing to dialect.
Did you get your readings and pictures? Johnny called over his shoulder.
The instrument men had gotten their depths and densities, but those operating the picto recorders, struck by the awesome scene and seeing much more of it to take, said no, they wanted another crack at it.
I'll take her, said Johnny. The devil's wife, said Dunnell Dean. Nah, McTyler. I have a feeling I'll be dancing this dance again some other day. I'll keep her, thank you.
He yelled back over his shoulder,
What do you want?
They wanted the slide debris at the canyon bottom.
I hope you all made your peace with the parson before we left, said Dunnell Dean. Here we go.
They plummeted to the bottom of the gorge and made a pass. The boiling white froth of the river fanged at the fallen fragments. They were mainly underwater. The plane fought back up the narrow gorge slowly so the picture-takers could track it on both sides. Dunnell Dean's hands were a blur on the controls. The bucking ship screamed as its motors over-revved.
Something is getting hot, called Robert the Fox.
And it had become warm in the cabin despite the altitude. It was the motor housings, overworked in compensating for the lunging and changing inertia of the ship. They drew opposite the top of the cliff. Johnny looked at it while the picto recorders were busy. There was no flat surface there where one could set down a ship. There was no space where one could operate a lowered drilling platform. It was all pinnacles and clefts. Johnny saw something else and called for vertical shots down the cliff face. The cliff was not vertical. It fell away inward. Anything lowered from above would hang 15 to 20 feet away from the face of the cliff. How could one hope to rig oar nets? They went directly above it, and Johnny saw something else.
Shoot more verticals of that top, he called.
Yes, he saw it plainly now. There was a crack inset about 30 feet from the top edge of the cliff, parallel to it. Another such crack had caused the fall of rock that bared the load. But here was a second one, just waiting for another earthquake. The whole load would pitch into the gorge. They went up 2,000 feet, and the picto recorder operators had to be content with general scenery. It was impressive enough in its gigantic beauty.
By your leave, McTyler, said Dunnell Dean. If it's home we're going now, I'll exchange with Thor.
Johnny nodded, and a near duplicate of him, who was nicknamed Thor due to his Swedish background, slid over the seat top, matched his motions to Dunnell Dean's, and took over. Dunnell Dean dragged himself back to the rear.
It's a reel a bit fast for the piper, he said. Are we going to have to operate in that?
The core in Johnny's hand was part white quartz and part gold. It was a very pretty thing. This was a lure that had wooed Turl, that had given them their chance. He wondered how many lives it would take. "Head for home," he told Thor. They were very quiet on the way back. 8. Johnny was very edgy as he walked Windsplitter around the mine site as casually as he could. What he was doing was dangerous, but one could not have told it from the easy way he sat his horse. It was a semi-annual firing day, and the personnel at the mine site were hurried, snappish, and preoccupied. Johnny had a picto recorder hidden in a tree that overlooked the site, and he had a remote control hidden in his pouch. He had gotten a long play disc into the recorder, but that would not permit it to run for hours untended. He had to get all the data he could. Robert the Fox would not have approved, for this was a scout, pure and simple, and if Turl spotted the picto recorder or detected the remote, there could be repercussions. Johnny had delayed reporting to Turl, taking advantage of the week or so order. He had heard by accident of this semi-annual firing from Care, the chatterer. Care had come over at Johnny's request to inspect the personnel carrier motor. Johnny needed the data. If it was faulty, that was one thing, but if it was only underpowered for the job at the load, that was another. So Care had come to the base, growling a bit about it. He was an operations officer, not a mechanic, but Turl had sent him. The midget cyclo's temper was sweetened, however, by Johnny's handing him a small gold ring a scout had found on the finger of a corpse, long gone to dust.
"Why give me this?" said Care suspiciously.
"Souvenir," said Johnny. "Not very valuable."
It was valuable. It was a month's pay.
Care dented it slightly with a fang. Pure gold.
"You want something, don't you?"
Care decided.
"No," said Johnny. "I've got two, so I gave you one. We've been shaft mates quite a while now."
This was a cyclo mining term for a pal who pulled one out of a cave-in or a fight.
"We have, haven't we?" said Care.
"Besides, I might want somebody killed," Johnny added. This sent Care off into a gale of laughter. He appreciated a good joke. He put the ring in his pocket and got busy on the motor. Half an hour later, he came over to where Johnny lolled in the shade.
"Nothing wrong with that motor. If it got hot, it was just being overdriven. You want to watch it, though. You keep running one that hard and it will go up in smoke."
Johnny thanked him. Care hunkered down in the building's shade. They talked, mostly Care chattering. Care got on the subject of being pushed by schedules, and Johnny eased in casually with his question. "What happens on day 91 of the new year?"
"Where'd you get that?"
"Saw it posted at the mine site." Care scratched his greasy neck fur.
"You must have read wrong. It would be day 92. That's a semi-annual firing date. One's happening in just 7 days, you know. What a lot of bother."
"Something different about it?"
"Aw, you must have seen a couple when you were in the cage down there. You know, semi-annual firing."
Johnny may have seen it, but at that time he didn't know what he was looking at. He put on a stupid look.
"It's a slow firing," said Care. "No ore. Personnel incoming and outgoing, including the dead ones."
"Dead ones?"
"Yeah, we're shipping dead cyclos home. They want them accounted for because of pay, and they don't want them looked into by aliens, I guess. Nutty company rules. Lots of trouble. They put them in coffins and hold them down in the morgue, and then... Crap, Johnny. You've seen the morgue. Why am I telling you?"
"Better than working," said Johnny. Care barked a laugh.
"Yep, that's true. Anyway, a slow firing means a 3-minute build-up and then zip. On a semi-annual day, the home planet sends in the personnel, and then they hold a tension between here and home planet, and a couple of hours later, we fire off returning personnel and dead bodies. You know," he continued, "you don't want to fool around on ordinary transshipments. I see you around on that horse sometimes. Ordinary firing is all right for dispatches and ore,
but a live body would get ripped up in the transition. You'd come apart. On a slow firing, the bodies come through great, live or dead. If you're trying to get to Cyclo, Johnny, don't do it with the ore.
He laughed and thought it very funny. A human breathing air, and built for light gravity, wouldn't live 2 minutes on Cyclo. Johnny laughed with him. He had no intention of ever going to Cyclo. They really bury those dead bodies on Cyclo?
Sure enough. Names, markers, and everything. It's in the employee contract. Of course, the cemetery is way out of town in an old slag heap, and nobody ever goes there. But it's in the contract. Silly, ain't it?
Johnny agreed it was. Care left in very good spirits.
Remember to tell me who you want killed.
And he went into howls of laughter and drove off in his old truck. Johnny looked up to the window above him where Robert the Fox had been running a recorder out of sight. Turn it off.
Off, said Robert the Fox, leaning out and looking down at Johnny.
I think I know how Turl is going to ship the gold to Cyclo. In coffins.
Robert the Fox nodded.
Aye, it all fits. He'll load them here, and then most likely, when he goes home, he will just dig them up some dark Cyclo night, with nobody the wiser. What a ghoul.
And so Johnny, sitting windsplitter at the firing site, was making very sure he had all the data on a semi-annual, just in case it was needed. The incoming load had not arrived, and Turl was rumbling around getting things organized. He had medical personnel and administrative clerks waiting to receive the incoming employees. He was very sure that there would be quite a few, for Numph was in pocket for every new worker, and he had said he was bringing in lots of employees. The network of wires around the staging area was being checked out by technicians. A white light went on. Johnny, sitting windsplitter up the slope, touched his remote to start his concealed picto recorder. A red light over the operations dome began to flash. A horn wailed. A bullhorn roared, "Stand clear!" The wires started to hum. Johnny glanced at a Cyclo watch, big as a turnip, on his wrist. He marked the time. There was a building roar. Trees began to quiver from ground vibration. An electrical pulse beat in the air. All employees had withdrawn from the platform. All machines and motors were off. There was nothing but that growing roar. A huge purple light over the dome flashed on. The platform area wavered like heat waves. Then 300 Cyclos materialized on it. They stood in a disorderly mass with their baggage. Breathe gas helmets were on their heads. They staggered a trifle, looking around. One of them dropped to his knees. An intermittent white light began to pulse.
"Coordinates holding," the bullhorn roared.
Mindsight Medical rushed in with a stretcher for the one who had collapsed. Baggage carriers converged on the platform. Administrative personnel rushed the newcomers into a solid mass on a field and then got them into a snake line. Turl took a list from an incoming executive and began to pat down uniforms for weapons and contraband, working fast. A detector in his hand played on baggage. Turl occasionally extracted an item and tossed it to a growing pile of forbidden articles. He was working very fast, like a huge tank battering away at the line, dislodging odd bits from it. Personnel people were sorting new employees toward freighters or toward the berthing section of the compound. The newcomers looked like half-asleep giants, accustomed to this sort of thing, paying little heed, not even protesting when Turl took things away from them, not challenging any of the assignments of the personnel people, not resisting, not helping. To Johnny on the knoll, this mass of creatures were in discreditable contrast to the Scots, who were interested in things and alive. Then Johnny came alert. Turl was about two-thirds down the line. He had stopped. He was looking at a new arrival. Turl backed up and then suddenly gave a wave for the rest of the line to pass on and didn't inspect any more. He let everybody through. A few minutes later, the newcomers were in compound barracks or sitting in waiting personnel carriers to go to other mine sites. The bullhorn roared, "Coordinates holding and linked in second stage." The white light on the dome began to flash intermittently. The personnel transports started up and took off. Johnny realized that